morning and welcome to the Pennsylvania Conference for Women. My name is Jennifer McMullen. I am the market director for Beneficial Bank. Beneficial Bank is the presenting sponsor for the second year this year, and we are delighted to be here. Thank you for all coming out today. As the Knowledge Bank, Beneficial believes in empowering women to not only be financially fluent, but more confident in making important life decisions. I encourage you to visit the Knowledge Bank in the Pavilion today. At the Pavilion, you can receive a free copy of your credit report. You can also take some Photoshops where we can directly email it to you. You'll get a copy of the photo. We can Twitter, we can do it all. Come by, take some pictures with your friends and colleagues. Also, we have a small business expert there that can talk to you about any advice you need. You can also contribute to any kind of donation. If you open up an account, we will donate $10 to a local charity of your choice. And then also, we have a financial library there where you can view some of the books for all the presenters today, and then you can go to the bookstore and purchase them. We are excited to be the host of Quieting Your Inner Critic so you can play big. You'll learn how to manage your inner critic by overcoming fear and self-doubt so you can access and convey greater confidence. You'll also learn how to become comfortable with taking bold action in and out of the office. So let's get started. Please join me in welcoming to the stage the guest speaker for this session, Tara Moore, the founder and creator of Playing Big and the author of Playing Big, Find Your Voice, Your Mission, and Your Message.
Good morning. Good morning. Nice to see you all. Great to be with you today. So we're going to be talking about the inner critic today. Who's in here because you know you're living with an inner critic and you suspect life might be more fun? This is really about fun in the end. Wouldn't life just be more fun without our inner critics? So I want to begin by sharing with you why I talk about women playing big and why I talk about our playing small. For me, when I went into the working world after graduate school in my 20s, I went to work for a large foundation, and I felt like I worked with the best women colleagues. I felt so lucky. I felt like these women I worked with were totally brilliant. They had great ideas, not just for our organization, but also for their communities, for their children's school districts, for the world. And we all became friends, and we'd be walking at lunch, and I'd often just be listening to them thinking, like, they are so great. They're smart. They're ethical. They're conscientious. I really wish they were in charge. And I started to feel the same way about a lot of my women friends, like just appreciating their brilliance and also seeing that they didn't really see their own brilliance. And I'd often say to them, you know, I wish you would run for school board. I wish you would be the one charting our organization's future. And they were kind of like, oh, Tara, Tara, poo-poo me. Not seeing their own brilliance. And I started noticing in myself, too, I was having a lot of trouble trusting my voice, believing in my ideas, and I had turned away from the career I really wanted, which was to have an entrepreneurial career, a creative career, to write. And I hadn't been able to follow any of that because of a voice in my head saying I wasn't good enough to do it. So I slowly started to take some tentative steps towards what I wanted to do. And I kept my old job and worked it full time, but in the evenings afterwards, I would, and on the weekends, I would attend coaching training programs and then started working with a few women clients coaching them. And I was seeing the same thing. I'd sit down with these women clients. They were brilliant. They couldn't see their own brilliance. And they were grappling with their inner critics. And then I also started writing a blog about personal growth and women's leadership and women's careers, topics I was passionate about. And I decided one day I wanted to do a survey and ask my blog readers, what's the biggest challenge in your life? This to me is like being visited by aliens. I'm not really a tech-savvy person. So maybe one of the volunteers can get an AV guy, and in the meantime, we'll somehow survive without our technology. So I did a survey of my readers, and I asked them, what's the biggest challenge in your life? Because I wanted to know, what were they grappling with, and you know, how could I serve them better? What topic should I be writing about? And I did this multiple choice list, and I listed all the things that we typically talk about as being the biggest challenges in women's lives. Like the stuff that the, you know, newspaper, magazine articles, and talk shows are always telling us are what women are grappling with. So certainly work, family balance issues, that was on the list. And stress, and relationship challenges, health challenges, financial challenges. I don't know what I want was one of the challenges I put on the list. But I added this other thing because of what I felt like I was seeing all around me, which was this epidemic of brilliant women playing small. And so I added on the list, I'm playing small. That was one of the choices. And when the survey responses came back, that was what the most number of women had said was the biggest challenge in their life. And at first, I was so surprised by that. I was like, really? Not work-family stuff, not health, not financial issues, but I'm playing small? And then I thought, well, wait a second, Tara, why are you surprised? Because you know you feel like you're playing small. You know a lot of your friends feel like they're playing small. And what I mean by that playing small, and what I think those women were speaking to when they checked that challenge, is some sense of, I'm not fully living my capabilities, my talents, my brilliance, or I'm playing small in relationship to my real dreams for my life. So the kind of playing big that we're talking about today isn't necessarily what looks like playing big in the world's eyes, but rather what you know playing big really is for you. So that might be something that the world would recognize as big. It might be a bigger salary, a bigger title, a more prestigious role. That might be what playing big feels like for you right now. But there's a huge range of how I've heard women articulate what their true playing big is. For some women, it's, you know, I'm gonna start painting again, and I'm not gonna hide my work in the basement and tell myself no one should ever see it. I'm gonna put those paintings up at the local art show. Or for other women, it's making a career change or starting a business. For other women, it's taking on a volunteer leadership role in their community or starting a project to bring something to meet a community need. So playing big from the inside out. And when we talk about playing small and women's inner critics, there's something I always like to get out of the way first, which is, are we blaming women now? A few years ago, I was going on a morning news TV show, and about 10 minutes before I was going on air live, the producer walked over to me. I was already nervous and hungry and tired, and I had been very awkwardly sitting in this green room where the entire cast of a reality TV show had arrived. And they were like loudly talking to each other, and I was sort of pretending to look at my phone, being like, what do I talk to them? Do I not talk to them? What do I do? So the producer walked in and she said, here's how we're gonna intro you. And she showed me this script, and it said, women are only 3% of Fortune 500 CEOs, and they're over 50% of the workforce. They're not getting into positions of leadership, and our next guest says women have no one to blame but themselves. Welcome, Tara Sophia Moore. So we're 10 minutes to airtime, and I'm like, I just so don't have the energy to find my voice right now and speak up to this woman. But I like hear this little voice in my head say, I'm not going down like that. So I say to her, I know this is a news show, and so I'm sure you want to be accurate. And I would never say something like that, so we better change it. And she said, I don't know if we can change it, and what would we change it to? And I said, well, let's change it to, there's something women can do to change those statistics. And she said, let me go check. I don't know. And thankfully, she came back and she said, okay, we'll change the language. So I tell that story because it's such a perfect reflection of how the media confuses this conversation about the external barriers that women face to our advancement and the internal barriers. You know, the media would love to have us say it's one or the other. It's either the boogeyman bad guy out there or it's all stuff that's women's fault. And I don't look at it that way at all. The way I look at it is we in this moment are coming out of this long, long history of women being completely excluded from professional life, from public life, from political life. And that history left some external effects, and it left some internal effects in us. And so when we talk about the inner critic, we're not blaming women for anything or making it their fault. We're just being wise women who see the whole picture of how this history continues to make its mark, and we're recognizing that we, in our moment, have some unlearning to do if we really want to move things forward. And I can feel you're all with me on that, right? We get it. So part of this unlearning we need to do is around the inner critic. So what is the inner critic? Well, I think a lot of you know, that's why you're here, but I want to tell you some ways you can begin to recognize it even a little more precisely. Because a lot of times we have lived so long with the inner critic voice that it's like the background noise in our head. It's the background music. And women often say to me, like, I hear you saying all these things about the inner critic, but that's not how my inner critic sounds. That's how I sound. That's my brain. That's how it sounds inside my head. And it's been like that for a long time. I'm pretty sure it's just me. And I was like, I know it can feel that way, but actually that's a symptom of when our inner critic has taken over so much territory in our minds, it's drowned out the other voices. But still, your inner critic is not you. So the inner critic is a very specific voice, and we can start to recognize it by some of these common characteristics it has. The first one, it's mean, it's harsh. If you hear a voice saying something to you in your head that you would not intend to say to someone you love, that's the inner critic. It's also very binary, so it tends to be a black and white thinker, like, this is gonna be a disaster, you're horrible, it's a word. Really, it doesn't usually talk to you about the nuance of the situation. It will also seem to be on your side. And this is why it can be tricky to identify it, because our inner critics usually talk to us in language like, don't say that, that question won't make sense the way it'll come out of your mouth. Or, it would be a lot better if you got 5 more years experience before you applied for that job. There's no way you could pull it off now. So it's going to talk to you in the language of, here's how to stay safe, here's how to not make a fool of yourself, here's how to do the rational thing. So it can seem like it's on our side. It'll also sound like a tape. And this is another subtle one, or like an MP3, we would now say. It'll sound like it's just going and running, not like you consciously chose the thought, right? Like, have you ever had this experience where it's like your inner critic just suddenly invades your thinking and you're hearing it, but you didn't really author the thoughts that it's saying? It can feel like a tape that just goes in our head. It's also often very repetitive. So there's this broken record quality to it. Like, we all have a few old narratives that the inner critic's been saying to us forever. So, you know, mine would be, you weigh too much. That's a big one. Mine would be, you are not enough of a polished speaker, inner critic. You aren't good with numbers stuff. These are old, old inner critic lines for me. And we could all look inside and see, okay, what are those ones that have been around for a really long time? And then at the same time, our inner critic does come up with new lines as we're in new situations and new challenges. So there's a changing aspect to it, too. For women, the inner critic will often show up around things that are traditionally associated with masculinity in our culture. So we're more likely to hear inner critic narratives about quantitative math and science kinds of skills, or about negotiation, financial matters, and unfortunately, sometimes also around leadership, particularly sort of traditional roles of leadership where you would have a leader and a group of followers. Those are things that are so often associated with masculinity in our culture. It just gives the inner critic an opportunity to say, that's not you, that's not what you're good at. So these are all ways that we can recognize the inner critic, qualities of the inner critic. Following me? Yes, okay. Another funny one that the inner critic can sometimes pull on us is what I call the 1-2 punch. And that's when, let's say you're at a party, and you're looking across the room and you're like, oh my gosh, like look at Julie over there. She looks so fit. She's in amazing shape. She just had a baby 6 months ago. Wow. You had a baby 3 years ago, and you know how you look. So that's punch number one. So you're doing that number on your body. And then punch number two is the inner critic would be like, what kind of person goes to a party with her dear friends and is sitting there comparing and like focusing on what everybody's thighs look like in their jeans? So it attacks you for having the thought that it just had in your head. That's the 1-2 punch, the inner critic. So start to notice as you hear these qualities, what are they evoking for you about what your inner critic says to you? And why this is so important is because the foundation of all of our work with the inner critic begins with recognizing when the inner critic is talking. When we know it's our inner critic, we have a whole bunch of choices of what we can do next, and we'll talk about those choices today. When we don't know we're hearing our inner critic, nowhere to go from there. Because now we think we're hearing our best thinking, or we don't even notice what we're hearing. We're just being run by that narrative. So the foundational principle here is recognizing when your inner critic is speaking up and naming to yourself that that's happening. And that can just sound like, oh, I'm hearing my inner critic now. Okay. So why do we have this voice? Why do we have it? Is it because we had like really traumatic childhoods? Now we need to go to therapy and figure it out for 5 years? No, the good news is no. I think we all have inner critics. I have yet to meet a woman or a man who does not have a really tough inner critic, no matter what our home situation growing up or our life experiences were. And we're actually hardwired to have the inner critic. So it's not pathological. We're hardwired for it. And the reason we're hardwired is because we've all got a safety instinct inside, right? And that part of us just wants to stay safe and in the comfort zone no matter what. It's like a survival instinct. And if you imagine, you know, this is my comfort zone right here. So if I'm just in my comfort zone and I'm like, I, Tara, am never going to write anything about what I think. I'm never going to publish a blog post. I'm never going to share any of my ideas. My safety instinct is like, that sounds good. We feel safe. But then there's this other part of me that feels called to write and gets a lot of joy out of writing and is saying, let's go to the edge of that comfort zone and put up a blog post. Like, let's do it. And the safety instinct has got to find a way to try and keep me in the zone of the known and the familiar. And it knows that if it just said to me, no, Tara, stay safe, I'd say, I want to write. And so instead it says, this writing sucks. Don't press publish. So the inner critic is a strategy that our safety instinct uses to try and keep us in the comfort zone. That's what it's trying to do. And so if you always listen to your inner critic, you wouldn't risk as much failure or rejection in your life, but you also wouldn't have the opportunity to have as much fulfillment and joy. With me? I wonder what slide came next in my slide presentation. Let's think about it for a minute. So that's what the inner critic is and why we have it. Sometimes women ask me, well, how do I know if I'm hearing my inner critic or realistic thinking? And I love that question because I never want to be the kind of coach that's like, any bad news is your inner critic. You know, just go for it, just go for it, just go for it. That's not true, right? Sometimes we're not qualified to do something. Sometimes we're not ready for that next step. So how do you know when you're hearing your inner critic versus just being realistic? The way you can tell the difference is by how the thoughts sound in your head. So the inner critic usually sounds very anxious and chattery and kind of chaotic and worst case scenario thinking. Realistic thinking, true realistic thinking, when you're in it, it'll sound more calm and it'll sound curious. And it'll want to help you find solutions to the problem. It won't just spin you and spin you. And I'll give you an example. So a woman I worked with named Claire, she had worked in corporate marketing for a retail company for a long time, and she wanted to start her own retail business. And this had been a dream for a long time. Like, she'd been telling herself for many years, after such and such many years, when I get to this point in my career and I'll be experienced enough, then I'll start my own business. But now she was past that point, and she hadn't started her own business. And she was torn. Am I ready? Am I not ready? Can I do it? And so when I listened to her talk, it sounded like this. I really want to start my own business. I think that would be incredibly fun. I'd love the freedom. I'd love the autonomy. But I don't know if I can do it. I really don't think I have the financial skills. I don't think I necessarily have the kind of charisma you need to lead in that way. And I think if the business failed, it would put my family in serious financial straits. That would be incredibly scary. I don't want to do that to my son. I really want my son to go to a good college. That's so important to me. I need the money for that. I don't think I have what it takes. We're going to be on the street pushing the shopping cart. So that was her inner critic narrative on the situation. If she had been doing realistic thinking, it would have sounded like, I really want to start that business. I don't know if I have the financial skills. How can I find that out? Okay, let me go meet with Judy's sister-in-law, who also started a retail business. And let me go talk to that organization in my community that helps entrepreneurs and see, do I have what I need? So she's thinking through the same question, but she's really looking for the answer, and she's gathering evidence. And there's curiosity, and there's a kind of emotional neutrality. So we can always be realistic and rigorous, but true realistic thinking will sound helpful and curious and buoyant and actually rational. It'll help move you forward. A couple other important things to keep in mind about the inner critic. I think one of the big misconceptions right now in our conversation about women's careers is that if you're going for your passion or what you're meant to do, you'll feel awesome about it. Our inner critics speak up most loudly around our most important dreams. So that's when you're going to hear the most noise from your inner critic, is when you're really on track and going for what you want. And that can be confusing. We also have some misconceptions about how we should respond to our inner critics. One of them is that we think empowerment looks like getting really mad at the inner critic and saying, don't say that to me, right? Or arguing with the inner critic. So that's like the inner critic says you're not smart enough and you say, yes, I am smart. Turns out neither of those work so well. Because remember, the inner critic is the expression of that safety instinct trying to keep us in the comfort zone. So when you yell at it, it's like you're yelling at a really scared part of yourself that just doesn't want you to fail or risk harm. And yelling at a really scared part of ourselves does not make it go away. It's going to inflame it. And then arguing with the inner critic. So we all have that person in our life, or maybe people in our life, right, that when you get into an argument with them, like once you have actually taken up the conversation, you have lost. You have lost because being in an argument with them is the biggest losing that there is, right? It's sticky, it's not nice, it's annoying, it goes on forever, you can't even remember what you're arguing about, that kind of thing. That's what it's like when we argue with our inner critic. Like, the critic might start by saying, you're not smart enough, and you'll be like, yes, I am. And then it'll be like, well, you can't do that while your upper arms look like that. You have to get them toned first. And you're like, oh, okay. And then you're like, maybe you even find a way to argue against that. And then it's like, but you know, you don't have the right personality skills. So it's almost like I call it the Rolodex. Like, it'll just go through the arguments because it's trying to just keep you distracted from going and doing the thing. And so if you're arguing with it, you're not doing the thing. So arguing with the inner critic, getting angry at the inner critic, not so effective. Sometimes when I'm teaching this work, this was a big surprise to me. One of the first times I was teaching about this in a big accounting firm, this woman raised her hand and said, why are we trying to get rid of the inner critic? The inner critic is what motivates me to do excellent work. And I've really been successful in my career because of that voice that makes me double check everything. And when I'm sure I'm not prepared enough, I go the extra mile, and it produces really quality work. And I was like, oh, I can so relate. Because I have been there, where it's that critical voice that's saying, you don't know what you're talking about, you just got here by luck, you didn't spend enough time getting this ready, that helps us do more and more work. And sometimes that produces good results. But it has some major costs. Because when we're being motivated by our inner critics, we've got cortisol flooding our system. We're stressed, right? It's being motivated out of a kind of fear. And what we know is that when we're in that cortisol state for years, it has serious, serious tolls on our health. The other thing about being motivated by the inner critic is that the critic can motivate you to be an awesome worker bee. You will dot the I's better. You will cross the T's better. But it can't ever motivate you to be a game changer. It's not going to motivate you to share your voice. It's not going to motivate you to take a risk. It's not going to motivate you to pick up the passion that you love the most. So for many of the most important steps we're going to take in our lives and our careers, it's not something the critic can motivate us to do. So what do we do with all of this? What do we actually start to do day to day to quiet the critic? So I want to give you four tools that you can use in your life when your critic shows up. And let's do a time check. Can someone tell me the time?
7:56.
Perfect. Okay, great. So tool number one, we've touched on a little bit. It sounds too simple to be true, but I beg you to go try it and see its effects. And that is noticing when your critic's talking and naming that that's what's happening. There's been very interesting research done that shows whenever we label an emotion with words, whether we say the name out loud, I'm feeling sad, or we write in our journals, I'm feeling sad, or we just think in our heads the thought, I'm feeling sad, when we put language to an emotion, it immediately decreases the intensity of the emotion. Now, this was kind of one of those studies where it's like, yes, women know this. This is why we get on the phone with our friends and say how we're feeling. This is why we write in our journal how we're feeling. But how great that the research is there now that shows us the part of our brains that the emotion comes from is a very different part of our brains than the part that has language and uses language. And it's sort of like when we link the emotion to the language for it, it regulates that emotion and reduces the intensity of it. So saying, I'm hearing my inner critic now, has that same effect of just reducing the intensity. The other reason that's so powerful is because when we say, I'm hearing the inner critic now, we're separating ourselves from the critic. We're no longer those self-doubting thoughts. We're the person hearing them. And now we have a choice about what we want to do next. So I even recommend, don't say, I went to the interview and I freaked out. Say, I went to the interview and my inner critic had a freak out. It feels a little different, right? If you freaked out, now you're the problem. If your inner critic freaked out, that's something you can deal with. So noticing and naming the critic, as simple as when you hear the thought, oh, that's my inner critic. I'm hearing my inner critic right now. And I can choose to listen to that or not. And hopefully what you're starting to get a sense of when you are thinking about the critic as the expression of that safety instinct, keeping us in the comfort zone, is if that's what it's doing, then it's not telling you the truth. It's saying whatever lines need to be said to try and get you to stay in that comfort zone. So when we get and hearing it, not the truth, okay. So this is really interesting because you'll notice I'm not talking about becoming more confident. And how many of you have watched or read something in the news recently about the importance of women becoming more confident? We should become more confident. There's a lot of books out about it now. There's a lot of conversation about it. My work sometimes gets lumped into that. But there is a distinction that I think is so important because I don't think we have time for women to wait on confidence. Our world needs us to speak up and lead now, whether we're confident or not. And for our own fulfillment, we need to speak up and do what we want to do now, whether we're confident in it or not. How many people in here know who Twyla Tharp is? Yeah, so some Twyla Tharp fans. So she's an exquisite choreographer, modern dancer. She's probably the most famous American woman choreographer alive today. She's won many Tony Awards. She's had an incredible epic career on Broadway. And she talks about how every time she starts a new dance, she's convinced the audience is going to walk out on opening night laughing at her. This is how our inner critics talk to us, right? It's not just that this won't be the best dance. It is literally Twyla Tharp convinced that the audience is going to walk out laughing. Another very successful woman, Cherry Murray, she's the Dean of Engineering at Harvard. She has 19 honorary degrees. And she talks about how almost every day she still feels unqualified for her job. There are countless examples like this. So I have yet to see any evidence that confidence is a required ingredient for having an amazing career, an amazing creative life, an amazing life as a leader in your community. But there is something interesting that these women are doing, which is they're hearing that voice of self-doubt, and then Twyla Tharp's choreographing the dance anyway. And Cherry Murray is showing up for work anyway. And so there's some little space where they're able to say, there's that voice, it's going, and I'm not going to let it stop me from doing my thing. So we're not trying to become more confident, but we are learning to have a different relationship to our self-doubt. Tool number two is to create a character that personifies your inner critic. And you can start to do this right now. This is a fun imagination exercise by simply writing down what are a few, and I'll take you through this step by step, but first, what are a few of the things that your inner critic says to you most frequently? And just write down a few of those lines. So if you need help jogging your thinking on that, maybe what does it say to you when you're getting dressed in the morning? What does it say to you when you are looking through job opportunities? What does it say to you when you go to a social event? So notice what it says, and then just ask yourself, okay, so when I imagine when you're hearing those thoughts in your head, does it sound more like it's coming from a female voice or a male voice, if you had to choose one? Some female, some male. And then notice, okay, does it sound like an older voice or a younger voice? And then from there, okay, so maybe you know, okay, it sounds like a young female of some sort, or it sounds like an older male. Ask yourself, if this voice had a full-on personality, you know, what would some of the adjectives be that I'd describe that personality with? So would it be perfectionistic or judgmental or hyper-organized or angry? What would the adjectives be that you'd give that personality? And then take that just one step further and imagine if you were going to create a character here to playfully illustrate your inner critic's personality, what would that character be? So sometimes people like to take from television or film. I've had a lot of Downton Abbey inner critics in the past few years. So it can be a character that you know of from popular culture. It can be a character that you imagine. If you're noticing that your inner critic sounds a lot like your mom or your dad or your boss or your brother, that's okay and that's not unusual, but I do recommend make the character like a slightly different, you know, similar type, but not that person, because it'll then get confusing if you're interacting with your sister and your sister's character. One time I did this exercise at a law firm, and I felt like the whole audience was with me, but then when we were doing this, all the pens stopped moving, and I was like, what is it? What, guys, you know? And I thought I was being unclear, so I kept trying to clarify, and still no pens moving, and I'm starting to get nervous. My inner critic's starting to go. And finally, I asked them, what's the issue? And they said, well, I can't write my character because it's someone that works here. And I said, is that why everyone has put their pens down? And they all went, yeah. And they all had, there was actually a couple people on the management team who were extremely harsh and critical, and this whole sea of people had internalized them as their inner critics. So it can happen that our outer critics become internalized inner critics. And I always recommend, if that's what's coming up for you, just find an alternative version of the same type. Okay, so why do we do this? Why do we create these characters? And how many people feel like they got a fun character they could start to do some work with? Okay, and if you didn't and you're stuck, when we get to the time for questions, we can talk about that. So the reason we create a character, one, again, it reminds us the inner critic is not the core of who we are. It's not who we really are. It's just one voice within us, and it's a voice that really intrudes and invades on our best thinking and on the kind of space we want to be in with ourselves. But two, the character can really add some humor and lightness to this, because when you start seeing your inner critic as, let's say, O'Brien from Downton Abbey, then it's a lot easier to be like, okay, I hear you, and I don't need to take that seriously. So it's just a fun, playful way to do that. Okay. Tool number three is what I call, thank you so much for your input, but I've got this one covered. And when I say that thank you so much for your input, I really don't mean it flippantly, but in fact quite sincerely. And another way I would talk about this, another way I describe this tool is with compassion, seeing your inner critic's motivation, seeing what it's trying to do with a lot of compassion. So it's really like asking yourself, when you hear that critical voice, what might it be trying to protect me from right now? What failure or embarrassment is it really petrified about? And then being able to say back to that voice inside, thank you so much for trying to protect me from that. But it's okay. I've got this one covered. We're going to go forward and we're going to be okay. It's almost like being the reassuring maternal voice to your inner critic. So for me, I just use this one a lot because I just had my first ever opportunity to write something for the New York Times. And for me, that brought up my inner critic in a whole new set of ways. I had my book just came out this week. I did not think the New York Times would cover it. My inner critic had decided it was too much of a self-help book and wouldn't be intellectually weighty enough for them. And then I got this email that said the New York Times is interested, and I was shocked. What? And they asked me to write an essay. And my inner critic said, you're not grown up enough to to write an essay for the New York Times. Only real grown-up writers can write for the New York Times. It said, after I had read some other articles from the same section, it said, you know, there's that certain smooth, articulate way that people write in the New York Times, and you know you've never been able to write that way. It said, it's going to be impossible for you to translate what you normally do to this new context and audience. So it said all of that. And when I thought about what were its motives in that moment, it was like, yeah, some part of me is just petrified of actually getting an email back from the editor that would say, we know you tried, Tara. But you're not grown up enough yet. And that scared part was trying so hard to get me to not take the risk. And what I was so happy about was that after trying to get these concepts into my head, because I only teach this stuff because I need to learn it. That's why I'm so interested to talk about it again and again. That some part of me got, yeah, like Twyla Tharp, like Cherry Murray, Dean of Engineering at Harvard, I'm going to let these voices have their major spaz, and I'm going to sit here at my computer and work on this article. So that's the work. It's not becoming more confident. It's not graduating from having an inner critic. I'm so sorry to tell you. It's about knowing that the voice of the inner critic is going to flare up whenever we start playing bigger, and that our work is to not take direction from it. And the fourth tool that I'll leave you with is one that sounds a little crazy, but I encourage you to try. And that's getting our bodies involved here. I'll tell you, when I first started coaching women, sometimes they would come in and all I would hear, they'd come in and it's like they weren't there, I was just hearing their inner critic. So what was coming out of their mouth was like the inner critic was version of a situation. And sometimes I felt like I couldn't even find them. You know, I couldn't find the centered, confident woman I knew they could also be. And so I would find an object in the room, like a basket or a cup or the, you know, the waste basket. And I'd say, okay, let's dump all the inner critic thoughts in there. Like, let's just put them in. And we'd actually pantomime it, like we were putting them in. And then I would take the basket, and I would physically get up and walk out of the room, and I would put it in the office hallway, and I would close the door, and I would come back. And I would say, okay, now we've taken the inner critic out of the room. It's just you and me here. Now what do you have to say about it? And I kid you not, all of a sudden, a different tone of voice, a different quality of voice, a different centeredness and relaxation in their body, and a whole different perspective on the situation. So removing the inner critic from the scene, and sometimes we can do this physically, you know, actually get up and move, pantomime, taking your inner critic character out, or put all your inner critic thoughts in a container and move it out of the room. Or if you can't get up because you work, let's say, in an open office floor plan and you don't want to be sent home for a mental health day, you can just visualize that happening. Visualize your inner critic, however you picture that, receding away from you. Or visualize that there's a big volume knob and you can turn down the volume on that voice. And you can just play with all these different forms of this, these, to see which of those tools click for you. So inner critic work is ongoing. We all have to practice this because it will come. Our inner critics will come up as we start playing bigger. But we so don't want them to get in the way of us sharing our brilliance. What's going to happen now is we have some time for questions, which is really always the best part because people bring interesting questions forward and interesting stuff comes out as we talk about it. So I encourage you to stay. There are also some sign-up sheets around the room. Raise your hand if you have a sign-up sheet near you. It looks like there's some in the back. And if the sign-up sheets are full, just flip it over to the back. Those are for my blog. So if you want to get lots of free, good inspiration and articles about your playing bigger, just sign up there and you'll get that. And then if you have a question, come to the mic. Now, everybody notice, what is your inner critic saying about your possible question? Is it saying, you have to think through your question clearly for the next 5 minutes before you're allowed to say it to the group so it comes out and makes sense? That would be your inner critic. Or she probably covered what I want to ask about, but I was spacing out, and that would be really embarrassing, so I can't get up there. So just notice this is your first opportunity to hear something your inner critic's saying. Label it and choose otherwise. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much. This is a wonderful lecture, whatever. Criticizing myself for stumbling on that one. So my biggest question, I think it affects me in my job, it affects me in my personal life. How do you silence the inner critic when it comes to social media? So we're constantly posting on Facebook or Instagram or whatever it might be regarding our children or regarding, you know, this latest promotion, and especially with some of our careers in LinkedIn. And so I think it sort of magnifies that inner critic. So any, you know, thoughtful tips on that would be great.
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts. So one is you might want to name an inner critic that specifically shows up for you around social media. Like she might be Supermom Pam, you know, who is whatever, right, or whatever the voice is, that strain of your inner critic that shows up there, give that a name and give that a character so you can use that same tool of like, oh, now I'm hearing, you know, Facebook Florine or whatever you're going to name her. The second thing I would say, and it's interesting, this came up in the earlier session, that whenever we're having struggles around jealousy or comparison, it's usually an indicator that we are not enough in love with what we're up to in our own life. And so it's sort of like if we notice our attention is being kind of compulsively drawn outward or drawn outward more than we'd like, the question I always want people to ask is, what is it on my path that maybe I'm denying, have turned away from, have let go of? What could I bring back into my own life or my own sense of purpose so that I am so consumed by that I don't really even have time to pay attention?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think I want to change my question now after you said that. No, but I won't. I'll start with the first thing. You said that we shouldn't argue back with the critic, which, of course, is great advice, but I'm going to argue against your inner critic, what you said earlier, about public speaking. I'm a communications professor, and I have to tell you, this is one of the best talks.
Thank you.
Right? Is it not?
Thank you.
Without slides. So, without slides, right? That
yeah.
takes some genius to kind
slides
of...
Slides disappear.
Right. But that's what you want. If your slides don't work, you can keep going on and go from there. But
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And the other bit that I wanted to change it was about the comparison thing. Because when I did my little character and the characteristics, or what I say to myself, rather, I actually was going on a trip to France this summer, and I said to myself at one point, I'm too fat to go to France. I actually said that in my own head. I'm too fat to go to France. Right? So, okay, that's nutty. Thank you all for laughing and not going, yeah, you are kind of too fat to go to France. You really are. Actually, should lose some weight. So mine was all about body image, and that's where I find myself comparing, right? Looking around like, oh, my God, look at you. Oh, look at, you're so fit. I love your arms. And so the comparison thing, so then what you're saying, and I'm sure this is not exactly what you're saying, but what I'm hearing you say is, yeah, I've moved away from losing weight, and I should, because if I'm comparing myself, so maybe you can just clarify that a little bit, because I don't really want to focus on that, because
right.
obviously I'm a healthy, you know, I'm a
right.
healthy weight,
well,
so I don't need to necessarily
yeah,
return to that.
What I notice for myself is that whenever I have an opportunity to step into playing bigger, my body image issues will flare
come
up.
Mm-hmm.
It really feels to me like that sort of impulse in me to want to stay out of the spotlight, to not come fully into my power, it will always find a pathway through that body image voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all the same practices we talked about today, right? It's like, yeah, going to France, that is a kind of playing big in itself.
After I lose weight.
Right.
Then I can go to France.
Right. So that part of you that's like, is it okay to just like go to France and have an awesome time and bask in the pleasure and spend the money? That is a kind of stepping into playing bigger. And mm-hmm. so we would expect to hear the inner critic come up then.
Great. Thank you. And I did go to France, by the way. Fat and all.
Hello.
Hello.
So I feel like this was kind of your high-level objective of this, but so I feel like once I overcome my inner critic, I get a crippling fear of other people and what they're going to say. What's everyone thinking right now? What do you guys think of my outfit?
Right.
So I think that my biggest thing is, I know, it's not that great. So I think that I have a really hard time, not as much with myself, but I guess it is myself, but more other people. I constantly am thinking what other people are thinking.
Yeah.
When I have a big idea at work, I'm scared because I feel like people are going to think I'm crazy if I suggest that. So sometimes I try to hide behind other people or something like that when it comes to work. Socially, yeah. I don't care.
So this actually was the topic of the New York Times piece that I was writing that I was talking about. And it's also a whole chapter in the book because it is, you know, we did today the deep dive on the inner critic, which is one piece of that journey to playing bigger. I think another piece is what I call unhooking from praise and criticism. And it's about the ways we get hooked, not just by criticism, but also by praise. Because a lot of us are good girl, good student, praise junkie, overachiever types, and our dependence on praise stops us from playing big as much as our fears of criticism. So it's about both. The chapter's about both. And the one concept I'll offer to you now that's just such a powerful idea to start wrapping your brain around is that feedback always tells you about the person giving the feedback. It never tells you anything about you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I... Yes, and I'll say it even in a more radical way, which is how I normally say it, but that feedback can never tell you anything about yourself, the feedback you get from other people. It only can tell you about the person giving the feedback. So you pitch your business idea to 5 investors, and none of them are interested. That does not tell you about you as an entrepreneur. It doesn't even tell you about the quality of your business idea. It tells you about what those investors are looking for. Your mom says you're being an irresponsible parent. That doesn't tell you anything about your parenting. It tells you about what your mom thinks of as responsible parenting. So the step 2 here is not then that we say, so screw you. Excuse my language. It's not that. We say, is this someone I want to influence or reach, or that I need to influence or reach? And if so, I'm going to really want to learn more about their reaction to me and my work. But not because it tells me something about me, because it tells me about this person I want to influence and reach. So if it's an audience member, a customer, a boss, a colleague, yeah, those are people we want to influence and reach. So I care whether you like what I'm doing or not, how you're reacting, but I care because I'm trying to achieve a certain goal, not because you're giving me an ego boost or an ego wound. So even for me as a writer, part of one of the most healing concepts for me as a writer has been to totally discard the idea that there is such a thing as a good writer or a bad writer. I don't think about it like that. I think about there are things that work well for the reader and things that don't work as well. So if a post that I write gets no comments and no shares, I don't go, that was a bad post and I failed and I'm a bad writer and is my talent running out, like leaking, you know. I think something about that didn't work for readers. So now I'm interested in the feedback because it can help me do my work better. But it's not about me. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Tara.
It's not an important one. Yeah.
That was a great question, and it's actually a lead-in to mine.
Yeah.
And I read your New York Times article, and probably like most women or some women in this room, I'm the mother of 2 teenage daughters at home. And my husband and I talked to them about going to college and getting a good job. And the article was about how women are overwhelmingly, or women in the workplace overwhelmingly receive more negative performance reviews than men, and an even more overwhelming piece of that is based on their personality, saying things like they're bossy or judgmental, and men don't receive those types of feedback. whether or not their boss was a woman or a man.
Yes.
So, that being the case, my husband and I struggle with the message to our daughters, which is, should we be tempering this girl power, unlimited opportunity, go get them, with the reality of how they'll have to navigate the workplace differently?
Yeah.
And be eager for your feedback on that.
It's such a good question. And could people hear? You know, yeah, it's such a good question. And how many of you feel like you're grappling with this in some way? You know, and I wish I had a great answer, but I think this is the challenge for women right now. It's like we're finding our voice. On the one hand, a lot of the research does show that we can overly diminish ourselves. We don't advocate for ourselves in ways that would benefit us, and so we do want to become more assertive. On the other hand, there's a lot of research that shows women are often called too assertive and abrasive and all of that. So I think one is, you know, it should affect what kind of companies we want to work for. And we need to look for the context of where we are going to be able to celebrate our voice, or where within our company is our voice going to be amplified. The other important part, and some of you may have heard this in the question, the research shows that women managers do this to other women at exactly the same rate that men do. And some of the other similar studies show that women managers actually have shown that when they're interviewing potential job candidates, they have more of that phenomenon of feeling like the person isn't likable the more strongly she advocates for herself than the male hiring managers do. So pay attention to where you are passing this on. Like, are there women at work that you think are too aggressive, that you think are bossy, that you would call abrasive, that you were like, well, she wasn't very nice the way she delivered that? And see where you might be contributing to this and put the light of consciousness there. My hope is also that as women get more liberated in their own voices, they will give more permission and encouragement to the women around them. Because we all know, you know, when you're with a woman boss and you're speaking out in a way that she hasn't allowed herself to speak out, something's going to be coming at you from her that is not going to be fun. Like, that is very hard when we're in the presence of a woman who is shining in a way that we have not allowed ourselves to shine. We lash out at her. And I've done it, you know, and we do it. So that's why the work that we do on ourselves also impacts how we can support other women.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about that you said the inner critic is sometimes trying to keep us safe or comfortable.
Yeah.
And I was thinking when you said that my inner critic is just mean.
Yeah.
Mean. And it has nothing to do with keeping me safe or keeping me comfortable. It's just mean. So I just want to know why, because it doesn't make sense in the context of my life for me to have such a mean inner critic. And if I think of the context of it's not keeping me safe, it's not keeping me comfortable, it's not serving me at all, other than saying I would never say those things to anyone else, I wouldn't even think those things about anyone else, yet I have no problem if I'm doing things around my house saying, I can't believe you bought that. You're such a loser. You didn't need that. You have 3 shirts that look like that. What is wrong with you? That's not doing anything for me. And, you know, so why is that there? And where does that come from? And I mean, now I see how to, you know, label it and control it. But if it's not to keep you safe and comfortable, what else is it there for?
Yeah. So sometimes the way it's trying to keep us safe and comfortable is very subtle. Like, it could be something like, safety is spending money the way your parents spent money when you grew up. And so if you start spending money in a different way, that's going to feel scary. It's going to talk to you and try and keep you from doing that again. So without being able to fully delve into it and know your whole story, you know, I'd want to look a lot deeper to see.
So you still think that it still comes from that same place?
I think it often does. I also think sometimes the inner critic is like a chronic illness that gets worse with time if untreated. And so sometimes it's just, you know, it's getting meaner and meaner and
yeah,
taking up more
it's,
because it's
been
allowed to. And so there was some root safety thing, but now we've just got like this meanness run amok.
Thank you.
Yeah. How are we doing on time? Maybe 1 minute. Okay, we'll do one more question, and then I'm happy to talk to you at the book signing. I have to go straight from this to the book signing, so come see me there, and we'll say hello.
So my inner critic sounds like Aunt Esther from Sanford and Son. So the problem with that inner critic is that, you know, Aunt Esther is someone that, like, we love and that we have respected and has, I guess, kept us safe in certain ways. But, you know, Aunt Esther made fried chicken and collard greens and did all those things for us as a child. So what do you do when that inner critic is someone that you don't want to be like, you don't want to laugh at, you don't want to tell the inner critic that they're wrong?
Yeah. Like, honey, thank you so much for your input.
Yeah, but she's not really feeling that because that's on us, sir.
She doesn't have to feel it. Okay. She doesn't have to feel it. So it's kind of like when you're driving on the road and, like, there can be a car next to you doing whatever it's doing in its lane and you're in your lane. You're just letting her be there in her lane, commentary, whatever, and you're moving forward in your lane.
Even though she gets louder when she gets disrespected? Because she's like, yo, you passed me. You know, she's louder when... The more you ignore her, the louder she gets.
So there's, I hope you have a chance to check out the book. There's a meditation in there that's a whole longer. It could be great for you to find out a lot more about what respect looks like and means to her and what she needs from you to feel included and okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.